Black girls are experiencing, they're being treated as less. They are being treated as less than as they are advocating for help, as they are trying to hold individuals accountable who, at that time, they are holding a grown man accountable. And our police departments right there in Kenosha did not live up to their duty to protect and serve.
And court documents show that there were at least 20 videos that he took of his victims, young Black teenagers. Well, that does it for our show. I want to thank David Bowen, Wisconsin State Representative in Milwaukee, and Ann Branigan, reporter for The Lily at Washington Post. We'll link to your piece after Rittenhouse protesters are asking, what about sex trafficking victim Crystal Kizer? Happy birthday to Dina Guzder. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon legislature is asking for $18 million to help resettle 1,200 refugees. An investigation by the Oregon Secretary of State finds the Portland Police Commander violated state elections law. And the WHO says the Omicron coronavirus variant poses a very high risk globally, as questions about the strain remain. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 29th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. The World Health Organization warned on Monday that the global risk posed by the new Omicron variant of the coronavirus was very high. Despite significant questions about the variant's possible effects, countries around the world rushed to defend against its spread with announcements of border closures and travel restrictions. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
At least 44 countries have imposed travel restrictions from Africa following the discovery of the coronavirus Omicron variant. Omicron, which is likely more infectious than previously discovered variants, was first identified in South Africa. It has now been found in at least 12 other countries, including the UK, Canada, Australia, Germany, Belgium, and the Netherlands. The specimen from the first identified case was collected on November 9th. The number of variant cases has increased rapidly since then throughout South Africa, which has a fully vaccinated rate of fewer than 36% of adults. Europe saw its first case in an unvaccinated traveler who went from Egypt to Belgium. There have since been at least 14 cases among approximately 600 people arriving in the Netherlands from South Africa last week. No community transmission has yet been seen. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, says Omicron has not been detected in the United States, but he added it, quote, almost invariably will go all over," end quote. The Omicron variant has unusually high numbers of mutations, which makes it harder for immune systems to attack. This likely makes it much more transmissible, though that theory has not yet been proven. The high mutation rate may also pose a higher risk of reinfection. We do not yet know how much protection vaccination or previous COVID infections offer. Many variants arose over the last 6 months, but most did not cause any significant trouble. The ones that did took several months to become dominant. Omicron took hold in South Africa in only days to weeks. Moderna is working to test the ability of its vaccine to neutralize Omicron. The company is also testing whether larger doses of their vaccine provide better protection. World leaders are moving quickly to plan or install travel restrictions. President Biden will limit travel from South Africa and several other nations starting November 29th. Canada is blocking the arrival of passengers traveling through South Africa in the last 2 weeks. Israel has announced restrictions covering most of Africa. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said recently, quote, "We are on the verge of a state of emergency," end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Oregon lawmakers are asking the state legislature's emergency board for an additional $18 million to expand services and capacity for refugee resettlement. This comes as the state prepares to take in approximately 1,200 Afghan refugees in the next 12 months. While dozens of refugees have already arrived in Oregon, 570 more people are expected to arrive by the end of February. A letter issued last week by State Representative Confam and State Senator Case Jama outlined the need for the state to invest in everything from housing assistance and case management to legal services for newly arrived Afghans. Jama said there is not a firm deadline on when the 18-member emergency board might meet to consider their request. Currently, there are 5 resettlement agencies operating in Portland and Salem that are working to identify long-term housing while providing culturally specific education, including language and job training, schooling for families with children, as well as legal aid. The $18 million requested by the two Democratic lawmakers is comprised of about $5 million to support the State Department of Human Services Emergency Management Unit, about $4 million to bolster case management and community outreach, $6 million for housing assistance, and about $3 million for legal services. In addition, part of the funding request would create a full-time refugee housing coordinator to identify vacancies, coordinate placement among the 5 resettlement agencies, and build relationships with property managers. Funding to provide legal services would support refugees arriving under humanitarian parole status who need to immediately apply for permanent immigration. The city of Portland is poised to pay $125,000 to settle an excessive force lawsuit filed by a man who was injured by police during an August 2018 rally. The man, Aaron Cantu, accused Portland police of firing aerial distraction devices, commonly known as flashbang grenades, into a passive crowd in downtown Portland on August 4, 2018. Cantu said a police flashbang grenade struck the back of his head and penetrated his helmet and skull. He says he suffered a traumatic brain injury. The August 2018 event, a rally by the right-wing group Patriot Prayer, attracted more than 1,000 counter-protesters, led to at least 3 people hospitalized, and was eventually declared a civil disturbance by police. The negotiated settlement with the city follows a ruling in June by the U.S. Magistrate Judge Stacey Beckerman denying the city's motion to dismiss the federal suit. Beckerman also allowed the suit's allegations to proceed that Portland police used excessive force against counter-protesters in retaliation for their protected speech and with an intent to chill their speech, while at the same time coordinating plans and security coverage with Patriot Prayer's Joey Gibson and his supporters. City risk managers investigated the case and determined that the city may be found liable and recommended adoption of the settlement. The city council is set to vote on the settlement on its meeting on Wednesday. Attorney Juan Chavez is the director of the Oregon Justice Resource Center's Civil Rights Project. He also represents Cantu. He said in June that he hoped the case would help police recognize that they can't, quote, indiscriminately fire into crowds. Another plaintiff in the case, James Maddox, settled his claims with the city in June. Maddox, who was seriously injured when he was shot in the arm with a rubber projectile during the protest, will receive nearly $23,000 from the city in an approved settlement. The third plaintiff, Tracy Molina, has had her civil claims placed on a hold until a separate federal criminal case against her is resolved. She's accused of disorderly conduct and failing to comply with lawful orders outside the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement building in South Portland on several nights in the fall and winter of 2020. Molina has pled not guilty to those charges. The cop who earlier this year attended a neighborhood association meeting in uniform and advocated for the recall of Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt will be fined a $225 civil penalty for violating state election law. The Oregon Secretary of State's Election Division approved that civil penalty for Portland Police Bureau Commander Erica Hurley after determining that she violated state elections law with comments she made about Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt. A state investigation found that Hurley promoted the recall of Schmidt last October and opposed his candidacy in January both times during work hours. In doing so, Hurley violated an Oregon statute pertaining to political campaigning by public employees. The agency opened an investigation in March after it received a complaint prompted by a story published in the Willamette Week on that same day. The story outlined comments that Hurley made in January during a Lentz Neighborhood Livability Association meeting. During the meeting, Hurley suggested to neighborhood residents that if they wanted to see more arrests for drug-related offenses, they would need to unseat Schmidt, who won the May 2020 election on a progressive platform of criminal justice reform. The Elections Division also cited comments that Hurley made in October 2020, also during a Lentz Neighborhood Livability Association meeting. The statute that the Elections Division says Hurley violated states that, quote, no public employee shall solicit any money, service, etc., to promote or oppose candidates or measures while on the job during working hours. Hurley has the right to request a hearing before an administrative law judge if she wishes to challenge the Secretary of State's determination. Funds from the federal government are helping two Oregon communities tackle youth homelessness. HUD's Youth Homelessness Demonstration Program will support a wide range of efforts to house young people. Eric Tegedoff has more on that story.
Funds from the federal government are helping communities, including two in Oregon, tackle youth homelessness. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development is awarding $142 million to support a range of housing efforts for young people. That includes $3.7 million for the Mid-Willamette Valley Homeless Alliance's work in Marion and Polk counties. Jan Calvin is a consultant with the Alliance who says they're currently in the six-month planning phase for using the grant. She says one important aspect will be addressing the needs of youths formerly in the foster care system.
A house doesn't end homelessness, so the additional supports that are needed and some that may not have been learned in such a tenuous setting and moving so often and having different relationships with people.
HUD also is distributing $3.3 million to the Eugene and Springfield area. The grants will reach 33 communities across the nation in total. Calvin says young people who aren't housed, especially folks from foster care who may be independent for the first time, face a number of barriers.
Whether it's transportation, other stigma and bias stereotypes that come into play, there can be legal issues and there can be criminal justice issues.
Calvin says while COVID-19 has presented challenges, it also has created opportunities, forcing efforts like hers to get creative. She says the Mid-Willamette Valley Homeless Alliance has put the feedback of young people with lived experience front and center while developing a plan for this grant, and getting that feedback during the pandemic has involved communicating online through applications such as Zoom.
Young people might even feel safer being behind a camera in a comfortable setting, telling those folks, including other young people, what we need to know in order to do good planning.
I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The trial of Ghislaine Maxwell began on Monday in New York City, more than 2 years after convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein's death behind bars. Maxwell is on trial for allegedly helping Epstein recruit and abuse underage girls, mostly in the 90s. She maintains that she is innocent. The 59-year-old British socialite was brought to the courtroom in Lower Manhattan from lockup in Brooklyn, where she has been held without bail. Maxwell faces six counts tied to alleged efforts to entice minors to travel and engage in illegal sex acts, conspiracy to transport minors with intent to engage in criminal sexual activity, and sex trafficking conspiracy. The prosecutor and defense attorney began by painting conflicting portraits of the accused enabler of Epstein. Assistant U.S. Attorney Laura Pomerantz, who gave the federal prosecutor's opening statement, said Maxwell identified and targeted vulnerable young women and then gave them to Epstein. Maxwell's attorney, Bobby Sternheim, said prosecutors were going after Maxwell because they cannot try Epstein, who was found dead in August 2019 in a Manhattan jail while awaiting trial on sex trafficking charges. His death was ruled a suicide. Sternheim said much of the government's case against Maxwell rests on the memories of the four accusers. While Maxwell and Epstein are suspected of having preyed on dozens of young women, U.S. District Judge Allison Nathan of the Southern District of New York has limited prosecutors' scope to just these four women, all of whom will be identified publicly by their initials. According to prosecution, all four will take the stand to testify against Maxwell at some point during the case. The trial is expected to last about 6 weeks. Since cameras are barred from federal courtrooms, there will be no video or recordings of the trial. The former British colony of Barbados has removed Queen Elizabeth II as the head of state in a ceremony that began on Monday. This means that almost 400 years after the first English ships arrived on its shores, Barbados will wake up on Tuesday as a republic. The move comes 55 years to the day after Barbados gained full independence but kept the monarch in its ceremonial role. Queen Elizabeth is the head of state of 15 other realms, including the United Kingdom, Australia, Canada, and Jamaica. Monday's event will see Sandra Mason, a Barbadian who served as the island's governor general or queen's representative, sworn in as the country's first president. In the 17th century, Barbados was claimed by the British and turned into a lucrative colony using the labor of hundreds of thousands of people brought over as slaves from Africa. It became a major hub for the production of sugar, an increasingly lucrative commodity that helped enrich British slave owners. A spokesperson for Buckingham Palace says the decision was a matter for the people of Barbados. Even with its new status as a republic, the island will remain in the Commonwealth, a voluntary association of 54 states that includes many former British colonies. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on tracing the backlash against critical race theory with David Rosenberg, followed by Noise Filter, debunking the COVID-19 pandemic. At 6, stick around for Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 51 degrees. Those clouds continue tomorrow with a high of 57. Today in history, in 1947, the United Nations votes for the partition of Palestine and creation of an independent Jewish state, despite strong Arab opposition. The quote of the day is from American sprinter, sports icon, and Olympic gold medalist Wilma Rudolph, who said, quote, "Never underestimate the power of dreams and the influence of the human spirit. We are all the same in this notion. The potential for greatness lives in each of us." The pandemic-related pause on federal student loan payments is set to end on January 31, 2022. Financial experts say borrowers should start making a plan to resume their loan payments or explore the alternatives if they can't. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Student loan borrowers, take note. A pause on federal student loan payments is set to end in February. The moratorium on payments has been in place since March 2020 due to the pandemic, but it will be lifted on January 31st. Andrew Pentis, a certified student loan counselor with the group Student Loan Hero, says the average student loan payment for Idaho borrowers is $274 a month, which can be quite a weight on a typical family budget.
The good news for borrowers in the state of Idaho is that more than one out of three of them have a balance of under $10,000. So that's a little more realistic and easier to afford in terms of repayment, as opposed to those borrowers with much higher balances.
Pentis says people should contact their loan servicer before the pause on payments is lifted and check into their options. He says people could also opt to continue the pause on their payments, but Pentis believes a better situation for many borrowers is to opt for an income-driven repayment plan.
What those plans do is cap your monthly dues at a percentage of your income. So if you've lost your job or perhaps seen your wages cut, your new monthly payment on your federal student loans would reflect that change. You could qualify for a monthly payment as low as $0.
While there was talk of mass student debt forgiveness at the beginning of Joe Biden's presidency, Pentis says that option is looking less likely. However, he notes there have been changes under the Biden administration, such as a fix to the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program to make it easier for government and nonprofit workers to qualify.
What's much more likely is that the Biden administration will continue to offer targeted loan forgiveness to groups that are particularly struggling with their student loan debt.
I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
A new travel ban begins in order to stop the spread of the new COVID variant. Biden hits the road to promote infrastructure investments, and the future of Roe v. Wade is at stake in the Supreme Court. With more on these stories, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We don't know a lot about the variant, except that it is a great concern.
To stem the spread of the Omicron variant, President Joe Biden announced that starting today, the U.S. is restricting travel for non-U.S. citizens from South Africa and seven other countries. Cases of the mutated COVID-19 virus have been confirmed in more than a dozen nations. Biden again encouraged Americans to get vaccinated.
We always talk about whether this is freedom. I think it's a patriotic responsibility.
Conservatives say Biden accused former President Donald Trump of racism and xenophobia for enacting similar travel bans in 2020. But Dr. Anthony Fauci warned that the variant could create a fifth wave of COVID-19 infections and also brushed off his critics as being anti-science. That includes Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul, who again pressed Fauci over his knowledge of gain-of-function research, where a lab intentionally makes a virus more deadly.
You won't admit that it's dangerous, and for that lack of judgment, I think it's time that you resign.
Fauci said no gain-of-function research took place with this virus. Others have called that charge a conspiracy theory. Tomorrow, President Biden heads to Minnesota to promote the recently signed $1.2 trillion infrastructure law. During the Thanksgiving break, many members of Congress touted the benefits of the law back home, including California Democrat Barbara Lee. She told union workers that underinvestment in infrastructure made economic and racial inequality worse.
Too often, the infrastructure that we built created more inequality. This infrastructure law now advances equality, equity, environmental justice, unlike any law that we have ever seen before.
The House is back in session tomorrow. Today, the Senate convenes to work on the National Defense Authorization Act. The Department of Justice is considering a charge of contempt against former Trump Chief of Staff Mark Meadows for ignoring a subpoena from the January 6th Select House Committee. Former Trump strategist Steve Bannon recently pleaded not guilty to contempt of Congress for refusing to appear.
Not just Trump people and not just conservatives. Every progressive and every liberal in this country that likes freedom of speech and liberty, okay, should be fighting for this case.
Bannon, Meadows, and other Trump allies cite executive privilege for their lack of cooperation. The nationwide right to abortion is at the center of a case before the Supreme Court this Wednesday. A Mississippi law bans all abortions after 15 weeks, before fetal viability. Catherine Colbert argued the 1992 Supreme Court case Planned Parenthood v. Casey, which she explains established the right to choose abortion up to viability.
Any restriction that is less than that places the question, is Roe versus Wade still the law of the land, before the court. It is my view that they are going to say no, and they are going to again permit states to ban abortion.
In a recent poll by the Washington Post and ABC, 60% of Americans said they believe the Roe v. Wade decision should be upheld. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy online at publicnewsservice.org.
Filmmakers document the story of a boarding school descendant. Seven tribes sign preservation agreements with the Park Service, and election materials are translated into three native languages. With those stories and more, it's Antonio Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. New York-based filmmakers are producing a documentary about reclaiming indigenous heritage. It's told through the experiences of an 18-year-old descendant of a U.S. Indian boarding school survivor. Michaela Savitt has more.
The story centers on Koo Stevens, a top-ranking Nevada athlete who organized a run along the 50-mile escape route his great-grandfather, Frank Quinn, took in fleeing from the Stewart Indian Boarding School to the Yerington Paiute Reservation. Remaining Native is the title of the film, which director and producer Paige Bethman, who is Mohawk and Oneida, says is named after the idea that he used his legs to preserve his identity, something that she feels many Indigenous people are struggling with.
Trying to preserve our cultural identities, our tradition, our language, because of how many obstacles the United States has put in front of Indigenous people to get rid of that aspect.
The film also follows the first federal investigation into the U.S. boarding schools. Bethman's great-grandmother also is a U.S. residential school survivor. Bethman says making this feature has helped her understand the complexities of her cultural identity and community.
That's what this film has brought to me, is that pride in being Native American, but also rebuilding a sense of myself that I felt like I've lost for so many years.
Production for Remaining Native started shortly after more than 1,300 unmarked graves were found near the sites of former Indian residential schools in Canada. Bethman notes that policies such as boarding schools and land removal were designed to disenfranchise Indigenous people.
The biggest gap of understanding is the fact that we are here despite all of those obstacles that we face, that we're not just something that is a relic of the past.
The team plans to embed themselves in the community in the new year to keep a closer eye on the investigation at Stewart Indian Boarding School. Bethman says the film will be released as early as 2023.
That was Michaela Savitt reporting. Seven tribes this year have signed tribal historic preservation agreements with the National Park Service. Tribes in Washington, Texas, Colorado, California, Utah, New Mexico, and Nevada are new partners in the program. The program assists tribes in strengthening their historic preservation programs managed through tribal historic preservation offices. Agreements transfer certain historic preservation responsibilities to tribes, which otherwise are handled by states. There are currently more than 200 such tribal agreements across the country. The U.S. Election Assistance Commission is releasing new translations of the National Mail Voter Registration Form in three native languages. The translations are in Yupik, Navajo, and Apache. Audio translations are also being used, which can be accessed through the form. The commission is responsible for maintaining the forms, which are now available in 21 languages. The commission is an independent, bipartisan federal commission working on requirements of the Help America Vote Act. The release of the translations of the native languages is part of the commission's celebration of Native American Heritage Month. The St. Regis Mohawk Tribe is establishing a health research center to support and promote student interests in community health. The New York Tribe has received funding from the National Institutes of Health, a four-year grant of more than $2 million. Partners include the Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center and its Indigenous research team. The research center will include two projects, Administrative Core Project and Scholars Program, which supports students entering health and research careers to address Indigenous health issues. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
One rabbi says the Hanukkah story can inspire energy conservation as the holiday celebrates the oil that miraculously lasted 8 days. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Hanukkah means dedication in Hebrew, and Rabbi Katie Allen says the holiday is an ideal time for Jewish people to dedicate themselves to climate action.
We have a responsibility to do as much as we can to diminish our personal impact and our communal impact.
Allen is co-founder of the Massachusetts-based Jewish Climate Action Network. She says the story of Hanukkah invites people to consider how they can conserve energy today. As the story goes, a one-day supply of lamp oil kept a menorah in the Second Temple of Jerusalem lit for 8 days.
How do we use that image of we need one cruse of oil to go much farther. So how do we make better use of the sources of energy that we have available to us and in a way that then reduces our consumption of fossil fuels?
She says reflecting on the miracle of the lamp oil can provide inspiration.
Every day it was like, oh my gosh, it's still lasting, it's still lasting. So there's a message of hope there.
So she says that as people celebrate Hanukkah, they can find renewed energy for climate action. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 29th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, your stories, and your tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and David Rosenberg. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Mary Sherman, Eric Tegadoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, it's Alternative Radio, featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Times Like Now with Trevor Collins. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Host Joseph Gallivan interviews artist Noah Matucci and gallerist Jamie Wilson about Matucci's show Random 8 at Agenda Gallery in Portland. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth look at the backlash against critical race theory with David Rosenberg.